It's really a pleasure to be here today and this afternoon. I'm a lot different than other presenters on the panel. Even my background and how I got to running an archive as a story in and of to itself. I do want to say, I want to thank the organizers of today's, Susan, and what you've put together, because it's a very interesting group that we have here. Susan and Vita and Harriet Green, who was here, who presented yesterday, serve on our Higher Education Advisory Board. That board is very, very important to us, and also Vika Zafran is part of our Digital Humanities Advisory Committee, so we would not be here for this, because our project has really grown outside of the academy, but the academy is so important to us. So partnerships also are things that have sort of led the day in our organization. I want to start out because we are basically a combination between public humanities and digital humanities, very much sort of centered in the middle of that. Digital humanities, for those of you who don't know, a priest named Alberto Busa was very critical in the 1940s, also very critical in our area, and he wanted to index all the works of Thomas Aquinas, and so we see him here, this occurring in the 1940s. Then we also have to look in the 1940s to Alan Nevins and his work at Columbia University, when he was concerned about doing biographies of people, and I think he was working on the biography. He worked on it of Ford, but also President Grover Cleveland, and was concerned about the turn of the century and people with the advent of the telephone, and maybe people weren't leaving their letters, which is reminiscent now of the internet and email. And so he decided to do oral history interviews of leaders to fill in the missing pieces. I say that because our project, The History Maker, sits at the intersection between, as I said, the public humanities and digital humanities, which are very popular terms today. I want to give a little background about my project and how I came to the project. I have a pretty eclectic background, but I often say that my project began when I was 9 years old, growing up in a small town called Newark, Ohio, where there were 1,000 blacks out of 50,000 whites, and the only thing that we studied about the black experience was slavery. And and George Washington Carver and his peanuts. I'm sorry, there were two things. And my 9-year-old brain could not conceive of the fact that he could have done all these things with peanuts when all we had been were slaves. Go forward. And also the other thing that happened was that the teacher asked us to talk about our family backgrounds one time, and everybody's hands went up. I'm part German, I'm part Italian, I'm part French, I'm part. I was like, what am I? And so I said, I don't know, Negro or African. I don't even think I would have said African. I said Indian, and that's why I was interested in the presentation yesterday with the Cherokee, because most black people think they have Cherokee in them. And there's that lore. And then I added in French because I didn't want to be left out. And that feeling really of not knowing stayed with me until I was in my sophomore year at Brandeis University doing research on the Harlem Renaissance. And I learned for the first time in the Schomburg Library that the song that I associated with President Harry Truman was actually written by a black songwriting team of Noble Sissel and Ubi Blake in the 1921 production of Shuffle Along on Broadway. That was an epiphany. I mean, you could have had me skipping out of the library. Black people had actually done something. They had they had contributed to the American lexicon. And I took my tape recorder to do research on the Harlem Renaissance, interviewing people like Butterfly McQueen, who was then Gone with the Wind, Lee Whipper, who was the oldest living black actor at the time, and Honey Coles, who was a tap dancer and historian, John Henry Clark. And those, so I put those interviews aside, but when I'm in my 40s, I don't have children, I'm starting to think about my legacy. I'm a lawyer. My mother keeps reminding me that I'm a Harvard-trained lawyer. And so I, those stories came back to me, and I wanted really for my life to stand for something more than where I was, and I was without a job, I should add that in. So I started my dining room table, and those interviews I had done came really sort of back to me. And I had a friend who was actually head of the local PBS station. As you know, often news stations were just throwing away what they did. They didn't preserve it. And so she had been going through their inventory and had been talking about the challenges of indexing and inventorying there, what was remaining of their collection. And so, because I didn't know what I wanted to do, I came to her after going back and forth and said, you know, I know what I want to do. I want to form a archive of Black people. And, you know, and I'm thinking she'll think this is a great idea. And she's like, that makes no sense. And so on a Saturday, two friends did an intervention to ask me about this idea that I had. And they told me to answer one of two questions. What did an archive, like I had envisioned, did it exist already? And if it didn't exist and one was created, would anyone be interested? And they theorized no on that Saturday, but that's, I took them at their word. And frankly, I would have probably been more critical. But what we are, what I created back in July of 1999 was a nonprofit organization called the History Makers. And our goal was to create the largest archive of video oral histories. Video was very, very important to basically capture Americans' history one person at a time. And that's what we sought out to do. So the term 5,000, I'm often asked about this term, this goal of 5,000 interviews. And that may, and I there's a theory behind it, because I wanted to do double the number of slave narratives. And I'll explain that, because that had been the largest attempt to record the Black experience until we came along, the WPA slave narratives. There were 2,300 done of interviews of former slaves done between the years of 1936 and 38 as part of the WPA project. And then as I had started to talk to people in the Jewish community, people were saying, you know, well, there's the Spielberg project, the Shoah Foundation. And they and I went out to visit, actually, Shoah, probably early in 2000. And they had done 52,000 interviews of Holocaust survivors. And that was like, whoa. You know, and they had done it in 5 years, and I had a goal of 5 years. But here I'm standing next to you, you know, before you 17 years later. So the goal has been 5,000. I thought I would do five in 5 years, but that has not been the case. I want to say that I started out also with a concept paper because the business plan seemed a little daunting. I didn't know anything about archives. I really had not been in education, and I had not run a library, and so all these things were, you know, things that I didn't know. So I started out with a concept paper, and I want to say something, and I raised this yesterday, is the issue of funding, because our estimates showed that this was going to cost $30 million, and people did not take me seriously. Our estimates were really right on track. It's cost us $17 million to date to build the collection that I'm going to show you, approximate $6,000 per interview to process the collection. Archives, we are a very serious archive. We've been created and informed by some of the best minds in the country, or we would not be standing in front of you. But the other thing is the question of not only preservation became very important very early in the collection, but also access was also, I was pushed into access, let me put it that way. In many ways, we want to expose the collection to the widest audience possible using new media outlets, public events, educational programs, and a digital archive. So from the beginning, I was very intrigued. And if you look at my original concept paper, I'm talking about a lot of things with technology, but I haven't even had access to things. And that's because a lot of times, anyone who's been in technology, things are being discussed many years before they come into fruition. We also want to preserve the collection for generations to come, and there was this concept of donating it to a nationally recognized archive due to long-term preservation costs. I want to just go back to a little bit about the definition of who we were. We defined History Maker, which I wanted to have a mainstream term. A lot of people wanted to have Black History Maker, but we were going to mainstream ourselves. But it's someone who is African-American by descent and has made significant accomplishments in his or her own life or associated with a particular movement, organization, association of event and time that's important to the African-American community. I want to say our collection has, this is only an indication of some of the topics that are within our repository. I mean, this is only a little snowflake of what we have, whether it's about food waste or Black radical tradition or sports or LGBTQ or STEM. We've interviewed 211 of the nation's top scientists, or shifts in beauty culture or migration in the Black diaspora or African survivals or integration in public life. There is a ton of material in our collection because virtually there had been no attempt to record the Black experience in the first voice beyond the slave experience. And I need to just stop there and explain the importance of that. When we were the year in 2014 where we became part of the Library of Congress, they became our permanent repository. Howard Dodson from the Schomburg Library stood up in front of a group and talked about the fact that in the 1900s, all Black people, no matter where they were in the world, were either under some type of form, some type of enslaved state or indentured state or colonial power. Think about that. And then he said that the 20th century was the Black man's century. And I believe that in many ways, the strides that were made by the Black community during the 20th century are really indicated in our collection. And so it's really, really important that we, through Access, get that information out. Just a little bit about the collection that we have formed. So I started in February of 2000 doing interviews, did 70 interviews that first year, focused on Negro Baseball League players, Pullman Porters, and Tuskegee Airmen. During that time, we didn't really have a list. Often people were asking us how did we, you know, select our people. We were sourcing people. We didn't really have a list. And then did interviews the next year in New York. I want to explain how this map came to be, but we interviewed people in New York and LA and Washington, D.C. And then in 2001, we got a grant from, which I, at a time that I thought we would have grant funding, we got a grant from the Knight Foundation, and we were able to go places like North and South Dakota, places not usually associated with the African American experience. So this is our map to date of where our locations have occurred. The ones in red are the ones that are not well documented. And you see there that Mississippi is in there, and we only had interviewed 3 people in Mississippi, yet 10 people in Salt Lake City, so go figure that. So as we move forward, since we're at almost 3,000 interviews, we really want to fill in the missing pieces of that, of the history, and are asking people to help us in that. I want to say, as I stand in front of you now, we've done, as I said, almost 3,000 interviews. Our oldest history maker was 109 at the time, Louise Anna Hines, who was a World War II Rosie the Riveter. Our youngest, because we were always wanting to do younger interviews, but our youngest was Aisha McMillan, who was a prima ballerina out of South Carolina before Misty Copeland came on the world stage. We've done interviews in 180 cities and towns. Even the Norwegian embassy flew us in about 10 years, maybe 12 years ago, to Norway to interview then 94-year-old Anne Brown, who had been the first Bess in Porgy and Bess on Broadway and had moved there in the 1930s and married an Olympic ski champion there. You'll see, even though I am a female, that we have more males in the collection. I often struggle with that. Sometimes when we have more, when we have a wife and husband team, I can get the husband to do the interview and not the wife, and we've got to sort of figure that out, but we're trying to correct those numbers, though people pointed out recently that if we were doing the project today, the numbers would be very much reversed. In terms of, you'll see that over 500 people have passed away, and the largest group are 70 and above. That has been our key target, and we are 17 years into the project, so we are losing people rapidly. And so often when people would say $30 million, you know, often I would say, you know, what value do you put on something whose ultimate value is priceless and will not be able to be replicated because so little had been recorded. And I do want to point this out because Vita Palladino worked with us on this project. And I now, with almost every presentation, we did this project in Martha's Vineyard. It was our first time, but my whole focus and a lot of my presentations now are on paper collections when we have nothing to do with paper. Because as we started to interview people, and we interviewed leaders in our community, when we started to do that, I started to ask people about their paper collections and learned that virtually no one, when I say no one, was doing anything about their paper collections. And very tragic examples in many ways, and I'll give my Angelou as the most recent tragic example, so I could give you a whole litany of things, and it's really a crisis in our community. But so Maya Angelou, when she dies, she has not, maybe she didn't, you know, consult or pay attention to a state tax lawyer, because her estate gets hit $4 million with taxes, and so things go up. You know, Swan Gallery seems to be the place where, you know, black things are auctioned, and so everything's put in a lot, and even original manuscripts, a very well-known art collection, all goes up for auction, not really identified as her collection. And then her house goes up on auction, and they have a garage sale on her lawn, Winston-Salem, for anyone who wanted to come on. We cannot afford that, those kinds of things in our community. And I can go down the list, whether it's Colin Powell or Vernon Jordan or Dick Parsons, or, I mean, I could give you a whole list of people. But I want to, at this juncture, to really acknowledge the work of the Howard Gottlieb Library and Vita Palladino, because I use as my poster child Nikki Giovanni, because back she was approached back when she was age 28. Her collection is here. And she's been sending things here for over 47 years, I think, every year. This is extraordinary, and it's extraordinary that you have also the King papers here and that he decided this. And the other thing that's extraordinary is that I can tell you that Boston University, Columbia and Boston University are all over our archives in many ways because these were places where people were able to come to school when in the heart of the advent of the Jim Crow era. The other thing is that we always had categories. So we've grown inside and outside. We've always wanted to be inside the academy, always knocking at the door. Originally, we're based in Chicago, so I was hoping we would be at the University of Chicago, but they never sort of got around to us. They were changing presidents. So we still are, you know, on that sort of fight. But we have 15 different categories. You'll see that education is the largest. We ignored music, sports, and entertainment, and really we are struggling, I mean struggling, to catch up in those categories, thinking that they had been already well documented. Education is double counted because we have within that category scientists, many of them in the academy. And so this is what we're hoping to right size as we sort of move forward. As I explained the WPA slave narratives, the thing about the WPA slave narratives is that the slaves were young when slavery ended and old when they were recorded, and they were hand recorded, and they're funny stories about, you know, where the same person may have been interviewed, and they tell totally different stories to the white interviewer and the black interviewer. I have David Packard here because this is where our collection is housed, and we had worked so hard on digitizing our entire collection. It took us 4 years. We turned over to the Library of Congress about 10,000 hours of testimony. There's been a lot of talk about partnerships. Partnerships are the only reason that we are around. And we're housed in this amazing facility in Culpeper, Virginia, and then piped by 75 miles of fiber optic cable down town, where people can go and, you know, see our collection. I want to stop here just to talk a little bit about how we even got to this point, because this is somewhat of a miracle. Though this, we actually got to access in our work on access earlier than we got to preservation, though preservation was in my mind. So I want to say that four organizations were absolutely critical to us. One was AMIA, which is Association of Moving Image Archives, which is where, he doesn't remember, but I met David Wexler, and actually probably in maybe 2002, toured Hollywood Vaults, which was like my dream, like, oh my God, I wish I could be in Hollywood Vaults. But it was in Hollywood, and I was in, you know, Chicago, and I was not about to part with our material as we were trying to process it. The other organization was the Society of American Archivists, Oral History Association, and the American Library Association. Those organizations, had I not been able to frequent their meetings and meet people, I would not have been able to be here. And I want to credit especially the AMIA, because that's where I met a lot of the people. And one of the meetings was a man named James Linder, who came to visit my office. I don't know. I mean, it may have been 2007, 6 or 7. And, you know, I'm sitting there trying to figure out, you know, I've got all these things here. What am I going to do? You know, my archivists, we had an association at that point in time. I think it's really probably 2008, because we had a partnership with the University of Illinois at a very, very difficult time in the organization's history, where I was really found crying on the floor of my office, you know, on a Friday night, just saying, you know, it just become too much, no money for funding. And we really have not been grant funded, much to my dismay. We've had some large grants, but no grant funding. So we are funded by events. high-scale PBS TV tapings that we have celebrities. So sometimes people associate celebrities. So it may be we started out with Danny Glover interviewing Harry Belafonte, and we've had Isaac Hayes interviewing B.B. King, and, you know, so we're sort of, you know, on a different path. But that's how we've had to fund ourselves, and those events have raised for us about $27 million, $17 million going to the archives. So many ways we were sort of, you know, robbing from Peter to pay Paul. But so anyway, 2007, I had to let go all my staff. 2008, the president of the University of Illinois, B. Joseph White, who is very, very important in our story, allocates $1 million in his budget. He comes to visit. He literally says, what are you doing on the back end? How are people going to have access? I'm like, back end? Who cares about any back end or access? I'm trying to just figure out what I'm going to be doing here. And so he forms this collaboration. I'm thinking that I'm getting free help, and people are wanting to access the collection. So I'm always trying to leave the partnership. But at the same time, it was out of that because the University of Illinois had this world-class library department. And we were able to, library school, I'm sorry, and a lot of our metadata, our digitization, all the things that sort of came out of that partnership are why we are here today. So it was in that partnership that James Lender came and visited my office, and he said, you know, this collection belongs in the Library of Congress, and this is one of the best partnerships that we could have with this team. Led by a man named Mike Michon at the Culpeper campus. This David Packard loves Moving Image. This facility where it used to house the federal money in the case of a national disaster was built with a gift of $163 million to the federal government. And so in December of 2014, we transferred everything to them as our repository. And I want to talk a little bit also about that whole exchange, because in the process of negotiating the arrangement, they somehow decided they did not want my tapes. Well, I had been housing them, you know, not being able to go to Hollywood Vaults, I've been housing them in a makeshift repository that had been an old bank vault, that really starting out as the only client with video. But they were down the street. But it was costing me more money as the collection started to grow. So I said to them, you know, no, you've got to take my tapes. You know, you cannot have my collection and not take the tapes. And that ended up being a saving grace. Now, when we started then, you know, to announce that they had not actually ever put the tapes on the shelves. It took us having an event there for them to get the tapes on the shelves. But I found out in the process that we were their first born digital collection. So part was analog that had been converted and part born digital. And they really had no expertise, and we were. In the press release, they wanted to announce also that we had saved the federal government $1 million because we were totally indexed. We had EAD finding aids, we had EACCPF, all these things coming from our affiliation with the University of Illinois. And so I said, no, you cannot put that in the press release that we saved you $1 million. But the fact is that they've already, because with video collections, you have to remigrate them every 3 to 4 years. And they've already done that work, so I don't need to worry about that. But I also, you know, have been talking recently to the Shoah Foundation, because there's some things that they do there now that they're at USC's campus. And I got a bill for $300,000, and I'm like, oh, where am I going to have $300,000? So, but I am looking for another repository just to hedge my bets. There are not a lot of places that can hold our collection. I do want to say that you can go there and you can look at our collection there, but it's not indexed in any way. You can look person by person. But I have Carla Hayden there because she was one of our history makers, and when we had our celebration in 2014, it never would have dawned on me that an African-American female would be, and one of our, and also someone we had interviewed would be the new librarian. And so we are looking to institutionalize ourselves there and really excited about the possibilities that exist. But the interesting thing about the Library of Congress, they're weak on African-American subject matter. And they do not, they have a little, you know, they have the slave narratives, they have us, they have a little gospel, and they have some music and some civil rights, but they are not strong. And they do not have anything indexed under African-American subject matter, so they don't really know what they have, so we're gonna hopefully get that taken care of. As I was saying, we have this wonderful, wonderful partnership. You know, for all the things I told you, we complemented their existing LOC collections. We had used Library of Congress subject headings. We were well organized. We had full intellectual control. We both had SAMA solos and had digitized things using these machines that James Linder had created. We had all rights to our material. Everyone, my legal background helped, and so there was not an interview that we will do where we don't own the full rights to material. And they were moving image experts. They had proper facilities, cold vault storage, and they were going to be our permanent repository. That has also heightened our visibility. I was thinking only out of necessity, but that has heightened our visibility. So I'm going to have to speed through these, but we collect in three major material categories, paper, but really paper just to document the interview process. Video, we had 14,000 Betacam SP tapes, DVDs, motion JPEGs, and we have about 50,000 photos at the time. That's what we transferred. We use a FileMaker database, and so all information, background information on people that fill out our questionnaire, which is not mandatory, is put in our FileMaker database. This shows some of the photos we have, but we have not had the project of working with that. And the largest photo archive is the Johnson Publishing Photo Archive, which is 5 million and still has not quite found a home. So everything was similar to them. As I was explaining, we had our born digital files and our digitized files. And we also always had a strict file naming structure that was very helpful to them. So they were learning from us as much, well, they actually were learning from us more than we were learning from them. So this just shows some of our records. We also were, and this also came out of AMIA, the PB Core database that had been created based on Dublin Core by PBS, but WGBH here in Boston. And so because we did not have the resources to have this a digital asset management system, we sort of jerry-rigged our own system that still everybody looks at, wants us to get out of it, but thinks that it's fine, you know, for what we have. We have extreme amount of data on people, and so we've continued to maintain that and index really at the finite level. So it was mentioned, Tom mentioned IMLS, and we also were the beneficiaries of a very small IMLS grant in 2001 when I had called a man named Howard Wackler, who was the head of the Infomedia Digital Video Library Project at Carnegie Mellon. And I asked him, as I was often asking people, would he adopt us? And so this is our other very significant partner because they have worked with us with no fanfare or anything for 16 years, almost with no funding. So that $163,000 grant I got to index and add to their database 400 interviews was... He didn't even want any part of that money. They had money from the National Science Foundation and Department of Defense. And he said, good luck, because I had put in 400, and, you know, it took us, we had to have like two extensions to go through that. But the thing is that this was going to give us access to the collection, because I had written in the original concept paper that we were going to combine state-of-the-art technology with traditional oral history, having no idea how that was going to be possible. So Carnegie Mellon became my answer to that. And so we have, so this down here was what it became at one point and what we've actually took into the universities most recently. I want to say, I'm proud to say that there are 30 universities that are now licensing our digital archive. It's cost us $17 million. So free access scares us a little bit because we were not sustainable and could not be sustainable in that way. So this is our tool, and I just want to real quickly show you it, what we are. Is it here? Good, thank you. Okay. So this is our homepage, and really the work on this really was the result of Carnegie Mellon working with this grant. So they did all the back end, and we got a separate web company to do sort of the front end. And our Higher Education Advisory Board were big big consultants in the whole process. So basically, the other thing I want to mention is we got, well, we didn't get the grant. The grant went to Brandeis, my alma mater, which is another interesting story because the Mellon would not fund us directly. But, and that's been our challenge as a project being outside of the academy. But we did get another grant just prior to this grant from PricewaterhouseCoopers, a $1.6 million grant to transcribe all of our interviews. This was, I mean, I've been trying for years, I mean, years and years and years past the original IMLS grant to get things transcribed, because without that, I couldn't use any of the technology. And so we did get that grant. We're in the process. We still have 800 interviews more to add. This has been another project that really has consumed our organization, which our organization is very small. There are about four of us in the front office, and I have about 10 now processing staff, and we need to even add six to them to meet our deadline. But I just want to show you, because I'm so proud of our digital archive and what we've come up together, and I'm going to... So you can just keyword search. I'm going to put in, I'm doing this for you, Vita. So I put in Boston University and King, I found this. So you can actually go, so here it will show you what number of people, whether they fit in civics or education, talk about it. You can search by gender. You can search by decade of birth. Sorry. And you can search by job type of the people that have come up in this search. So I put in Martin Luther King, and I'm going to go to Lula Dawson. You know, like if I like any of these clips, you know, I can add them to my playlist. We have indexed this so the name appears. You see these hashtags here, that's every place where Boston University or King, you know, my search terms are mentioned. So I want to go to this.
Oh, by the way,
And I want to say Lula Dawson was married. She's deceased now, but her husband was Ambassador Dawson, and they were teams spent a lot of time on the continent of Africa
King, that's where I met him. I met Martin Luther, and
he was Boston University.
And Douglas E. Lane Moore was at Boston University. Bishop Adams. But interestingly enough, I wasn't that friendly with Martin Luther, but Martin Luther used to have. King used to have what they call, he would call a wine sip every Sunday afternoon.
No, he would have it.
He was one of the few who had money. And his father had told him he wanted to marry. So he started looking over the girls. I was in his apartment the day he met Cloretta.
Okay. So maybe we have some extra history you didn't know about, Vito, over there that you can add. The other thing, I want to go quickly here, but you can also, because now we have, I think now it's 2,200, we're adding every day, but we interviewed President Barack Obama when he was Illinois State Senator. And so
I'm Barack Obama.
Oh, sorry.
That's spelled B-A-R-A-C-K. O-B-A-M-A, and my birthday is August 4th, 1961, and today is February 16th, 2001.
Okay, we're in Chicago, Illinois, and also your profession, Barack?
I am a state senator and also a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School.
So there are a lot of things I could show, but I've run out of time, but I just want to say we have also this inferential indexing that we called here, where you can actually search by things that are not keyword searchable. We're hoping that as we move forward within the academy and our user database, that people will be able to do user tagging. And we did this, we also have another project with Yale and our digital humanities group where they've actually done topic modeling, so we're looking to combine those. I'm gonna finish right now and turn it over to, oh no, we're taking a break. Okay, thanks.